Hey, everybody. Welcome to Surface Level, curious conversations about the Black and queer experience. I'm one of your hosts, Tony, and today, Jordan, Damon, and I are exploring the roots of comedy and the impact it has on the cultural landscape. Today, we're highlighting Loretta Mary Akin, known as Moms Mabley.
Yes. Right now on the internet, if I'm telling the truth, everyone wants to pretend to be Black and everyone wants to pretend to be queer. So
that's true.
As a group of people who actually do this shit, who got it out the mud, exactly. Who were in the trenches in middle school.
Yeah.
If you weren't pretending to be gay in middle school, I don't want you wearing a dangling earring, straight boy on TikTok.
Why do you think people, and I'm talking about queer and non-queer people, have such a challenge digesting the concept of bisexuality?
They go, oh, you can't be bi because that means you have to sleep with a woman, and that woman can't want you because mm-hmm. you're too gay. And you go, what? She like this gay ass nigga. I don't know what to say.
Can I say this? What's the line I'm crossing here? And I'm just like, then you end up not doing anything.
Yeah, then you end up not doing anything. And also, like, are you making fun of that woman for being dumb, Caitlyn Jenner? Or are you making fun of that woman for being trans? Because I have a Caitlyn Jenner joke where I say I think she's a groundbreaker. I think she's a trailblazer because she became America's first crazy, conservative, trans Fox News grandma. Mm-hmm. We don't have a lot of those.
This is Queens of Comedy. Yes, I like Queens of Comedy. Wasn't that a real thing, right?
Yeah,
Monique and all the girls.
Monique, Samore.
Yeah.
Adele Givens. And Miss Laura.
Yeah, Miss Laura. Mm-hmm. I loved Queens of Comedy. And then there was Kings of Comedy. So that was a whole moment. We were just young whippersnappers at the time.
Mm-hmm. Just DVDs being sold in barbershops.
DVDs being sold in barbershops.
And they were not legal all the time. Let's be honest.
I was selling DVDs.
Oh, you were boosting?
The ghetto.
And CDs.
Entrepreneur.
The ghetto.
I had the little computer where you could do the laser imprint design on the actual disc. I had a business.
All right.
School.
Okay, FBI, we got him. We got him. You saw what was at the beginning of those tapes. It said, FBI, no piracy, get him. We found her.
You're a pirate.
So as some of you have heard, there is a fourth dream today. And so I'm going to go ahead and introduce our guest. So today's guest is a comedic force hailing from Mississippi and is taking the comedy scene by storm. Uh-huh. He's a staff writer for Apple TV Plus's Emmy-nominated show, The Problem with Jon Stewart. He's appeared on the biggest late-night TV shows such as The Tonight Show, starring Jimmy Fallon, The Late Show with Stephen Colbert, and The Late Late Show with James Corden. And in 2022, he was named one of Variety's 10 comics to watch. And we first came across him on social media where we just knew we had to have him pull up to the table. So today we welcome Jay Jordan to our Surface Level family.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Yes. I see the clips. I love the clips. I love Black queer thoughts on things because both of those intersections, I think, make for better comedy. I think they make for better content. Mm-hmm. Right now on the internet, if I'm telling the truth, everyone wants to pretend to be Black and everyone wants to pretend to be queer. So as a group of people who actually do this shit, who got it out the mud, exactly. Who were in the trenches in middle school.
Yeah.
If you weren't pretending to be gay in middle school, I don't want you wearing a dangling earring, straight boy on TikTok.
Now, it's so funny because we actually talk about this on one of our episodes this season about people who are perpetrating the fraud.
Faking the funk. It's like what Paul Mooney said, speaking of famous queens. Paul Mooney once said, everybody want to be a nigga, don't nobody want to be a nigga. Mm-hmm. I like to think everybody want to be a faggot, don't nobody want to be a faggot.
Right.
We are entering that phase.
So are we talking about faggots?
We didn't say anything, Noah Beck. Don't get mad.
We didn't say anything bad, but this season we're all about reflection and reflecting on our icons. And so today we're highlighting Loretta Mary Akin, known as Moms Mabley.
Yes.
Who was a pioneering Black stand-up comedian who shattered gender and racial barriers with her distinctive style, tackling social and political issues, and later on became an icon, leaving a legacy that challenges norms and promotes social change.
Yes.
And if you want to know more information about Moms Mabley, there's an awesome documentary on Max called Whoopi Goldberg Presents Moms Mabley. Mm-hmm. I suggest you all go out and watch that.
That's amazing.
So we're going to do a little bit of true-false, and it's all centered around Moms Mabley to sort of tie in some information that people might not be, you know, they might not know. So the first thing I have here is, true or false, Moms Mabley was known for her distinctive appearance, often wearing elegant dresses and elaborate hats on stage. True or false?
False. She dressed down. That's right. Very mm-hmm. much down.
That's right. Mm-hmm. So Moms Mabley had more of a casual, unconventional style, wearing raggedy clothes and a floppy hat, which became part of her iconic look.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Good job.
She was wearing a house dress before Tyler. She was wearing a muumuu. She was wearing a duster on TV before Miss Perry.
Exactly. So Moms Mabley became the first comedian to perform, the first female comedian to perform at the Apollo Theater in Harlem. True or false?
I want to say true.
I want to say true.
I'm going to say true.
Yes. So Moms Mabley made history as the first female comedian to perform at the Apollo Theater, which was a significant achievement. And she actually then went on to play Carnegie Hall later on. So it was just a big moment because she was actually the only one doing it. Like, she was doing it. True or false, Moms Mabley faced backlash for discussing her sexuality in her comedy.
True,
because she wasn't just, she was also like horny on stage.
She was horny on stage. She was
horny.
Okay, so you got that wrong.
Oh, false?
It's false. So while societal norms of the time made it challenging for the LGBTQ plus individuals, Moms Mabley's audience generally appreciated her authenticity and found her openness sort of groundbreaking. So they actually used to call her after the show was done. She would get off stage, put on her suit and her zoot suit and her hat, and they called her Mr. Mom.
Ooh.
Work.
Mr. Mom. Mr. Mom. You know, she had all the girls on her.
I love that.
And it was kind of like everyone knew, but no one was saying anything, you know?
Yeah.
All right. So last one, true or false, Moms Mabley, her legacy is recognized for its significant contribution to both comedy and civil rights activism.
True.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
Oh, I was just like, I was going to say false.
Well, no, because in the era of Moms Mabley and later Dick Gregory, a lot of the comedians were very active in the movement.
Yeah. So this is true. Moms Mabley's impact transcends comedy as she used her platform to address social and political issues, contributing to the broader conversations around civil rights and societal change. So one of her most notable pieces of work was when she sung her version of Abraham, Martin, and John, which was a song that connected the assassinations of those three individuals. Hmm. I think a lot of folks would find, so if you have some time on your hands, go back and look at Moms Mabley's work. It's hilarious, and I think you'd have a great time just taking in that history, because a lot of people just don't know about Moms Mabley. And lastly, for you, Jay, this is a question we ask all of our guests.
Oh, no.
What are you curious about?
Ooh, I'm curious about where stand-up comedy is headed. And by curious, I also mean excited. I'm looking forward to like a lot of my peers and the people who I see who are making really good and really fun and more importantly, really funny work. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious about where we're headed. Because right now, you know, with a lot of things, there's so many famous people at the top that there are a lot of people online who go, oh, I don't really like stand-up comedy. And I go, well, when's the last time you like actually saw a show with like, I don't know, like some 30-year-olds and late 20-somethings? Because what they have in their head, and we respect everyone, we respect the old guard, but what they have in their head is there's this bunch of like 60-year-olds. You think stand-up comedy is just multimillionaires who already made it already? What? That, come on. That can't be the case. That can't be how you look at art form that is still thriving and continuing and shifting and like adding new people, and like you see people blow up and then everyone just complains about all these old people and you're like, well, girl, why somebody new?
Yeah.
I don't know what to tell you.
Exactly.
Okay.
Well, Jay, speaking of stand-up comedy, Tony already kind of talked about your background and all of your accomplishments. I'm curious to know what inspired you to start in comedy? Because I think a lot of people think they're funny.
Yes. Yes.
Know? Right.
And a lot of people are funny. I like to always say a lot of people are very funny. A lot of people are very brunch funny. It's hard to be funny in a room full of people who are expecting you to be funny for desired amount of time repeatedly and almost predictably. What you have to think about is, can you do this every night for different groups of people versus like, oh, can I just like kiki with my friends? Cause that's like a different skill set. Mm-hmm. And like some people can do both. I think like, especially Black queer people have an inclination to like find humor in things and to interact with people in a way that is fun and that can be funny.
Yeah.
So a lot of times Black people, when they do comedy to non-Black people, like, oh, it's so natural. And you go, but girl, this is just me at home. Mm-hmm. Like, I'll actually do some jokes in a second. We're actually just kicking it. What inspired me? I moved to New York in 2015, and I had a BA in English, a BFA in acting, and an MFA in acting. And so I moved here, signed by a theatrical agent who I'm no longer with.
So it went well.
It went so well. One time they sent me to an audition, and they said, on a scale of 1 to 10, how well can you tap? And I said, are there negative numbers? Girl, you ain't going to have me tap dancing. And so what happened... And what happened is that I had done like some like one man shows. I had like written a one man show for my grad program that then ended up becoming like the first 5 minutes of my stand up. I was in New York. I didn't have any control over my career. As an actor, mm-hmm. you truly like kind of give up all autonomy except for when you audition. And when you're an actor, everyone has to say, please do this with us. When you're a stand-up, you can say, hey, I kind of want to do this thing on my own. So I just started going to mics in New York City, and I loved it. I did a show at Vodka Soda Bottoms Up one time for my friend. You remember back in the day?
Yeah.
Vodka Soda Bottoms Up in Hell's Kitchen.
Down there by the Ritz?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Ritz. Oh, Lord.
Flashbacks.
The Ritz. Oh, Jesus Christ. Oh, my God. Skinny jean era. Okay, so... So what happened is that I did stand up for my friend at his show at Vodka Soda Bottoms Up. And then, like, I just kept doing it. And then I want to say around 2017, I, like, won a couple things, like, kind of in the city. And then the next year, I got a really cool opportunity with Stand Up NBC. And so then, like, inertia kept rolling. And then a bunch of fun stuff happened after that. So I was kind of inspired by the fact that I love stand-up, and I wanted to have more control over my career, and I wanted to be able to talk about the things I wanted to talk about.
Mm-hmm. Mm. So do you, speaking of being brunch money, when you're out with just, like, your regular folks,
mm-hmm.
I'm when you came in here even to the studio, I was like, is there a pressure in the back of your mind of, like, I got to be the funny person, I got to make people laugh?
No, because there's such
or
a relief.
Or do people have that expectation of you?
Well, sometimes, maybe, but there's such a relief when other people are just as funny and have as much fun in social settings. Mm-hmm. Because sometimes at a party, if you're a comic, you don't want to be telling jokes. You want to be dancing. You want to be doing drugs. You want to be drinking. You want you know what I'm saying? Like, because at the end of the day, you're still a person.
Right. Yeah.
Like, I was at the party last night, and there were some famous comedians there. They didn't want to tell no jokes.
Yeah.
You know what they wanted to do? They wanted to turn up the Sexy Red. That's what they wanted to do. Okay. I was like, wait a second. What? Okay. Bend that ass over?
No. Okay.
It's like when we go out, people are like, talk to me like, are you on the podcast? We're at a
circuit party. Imagine trying to have a podcast talk in a harness. Imagine.
This happened.
Girl, I can't talk to you. You got to take the pup mask off. What is wrong with you?
They were like, you on that podcast? I said, not tonight, baby. Not tonight.
Listen, I mean, speaking of stand-up, so one of the subject matters you talk about that caught our attention is your experience being bisexual or queer, and how people sometimes have challenges digesting that. I'm just curious, like, from your perspective, why do you think people, and I'm talking about queer and non-queer people, have such a challenge digesting the concept of bisexuality?
Ooh, I think it's rooted in a couple of things. I think when we're talking about bisexual men, I think any sort of biphobia when it comes to bisexual men is really just like dressed up homophobia.
Mm-hmm.
And so that kind of plays into this idea like, oh no, it's not that I like don't think people can be bi. You know, it's just like, but like you're a guy. And then, so it's homophobia. They're always afraid that a bisexual man is, and this is part of our history. I'm glad we're talking about it in December. There's this lingering fear when it comes to like DL men being bi and the transmission of HIV that the Black community, like, knows how to talk about, but they don't necessarily know how to actually talk about bisexuality in a way that mm-hmm. is celebratory. All they know how to do is say, oh, well, you know, he's sneaking around. It's part of history and a legacy of shame that I don't want to continue. So that's why I talk about it. And then the third thing, people don't ever think that a woman is going to want a bisexual man because they think that women hate gay men. It's this weird, like, they mm-hmm. go, oh, you can't be bi because that means you have to sleep with a woman, and that woman can't want you because mm-hmm. you're too gay. And you go, what? She like this gay ass nigga. I don't know what to say. I don't know what to say. That's not, ask her. Don't ask me. Yeah. I think that's on the male bisexual end. I think on the female bisexual end, sometimes people definitely like, they objectify women who happen to be bisexual in a way that, like, they don't objectify men. Mm-hmm. So I think that's, like, part of that struggle for them. But as a bisexual man, I like, know when people are uncomfortable. I'm always like, oh, okay. Yeah. I understand, like, what you're kind of like, oh, I don't understand. I'm like, but yeah. At the end of the day, we're talking about sexuality as a dimmer, not a switch. So, like, I'm married to a man, but I'm still bisexual. So, mm-hmm.
you know. Mm-hmm. Well, you know what? As a matter of fact, I did some research.
Whoop.
And so, hold on. Whoop. Take me. I'm moving slow today.
Take your time. Take your time.
Speaking of Moms Mabley, I'm moving very slow today.
It's okay, Mr. Mom.
So, listen. Exactly. So, an article titled, I don't know who needs to hear this, but You Are Bi Enough in the New York Times says that bisexual people exist. In fact, according to Gallup, the majority of adults in the LGBTQ community identify as bisexual at 54.6%. Mm-hmm. It said that, this is an older stat right here, bisexual people are less likely, however, to be out. In 2013, only 28% of bisexual people said that they were out to most or all the important people in their lives, compared to 77% of gay men and 71% mm-hmm. of lesbians, according to the Pew Research Center. And so what I think I'm hearing here is, like, folks who are bisexual, a lot of times they don't even want to claim it because they feel like people don't understand it. Yeah. And they won't allow you to be bisexual. Like, you gotta be one or the other.
Oh yeah.
And so I think that's a lot of the plight of
That makes a lot of sense. I mean, especially in the Black community, what I think about is that episode of Insecure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
when Molly.
You know who played that actor, Langston, who's a comedian, who's very, very funny.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and like, I just thought that storyline was so interesting to see it played out on TV, because Molly was feeling this dude, and as soon as she found out that the guy had an experience in the past and didn't even identify as bisexual or gay, but just had an experience with a man years prior, she couldn't get over it. It was like this crippling fear that like at some point in the relationship she would be discarded, or that he wasn't being truthful. And so that stat that you mentioned makes a lot of sense, where people who are bisexual may feel like, if I bring this out, especially, because I feel like within the queer community, we also do a part of denying bisexuality. Well, that's why the question was not just straight women.
The question was like both queer and non-queer folks.
Yeah.
Because we're guilty of it as well.
Right.
Because I'm bisexual. You gay, baby. You just don't know what it is. Right. Like, I talk about that even like in my experience coming out. Like, I initially came out as bi, and I was like, I didn't feel like I could even be that.
Yeah.
And I think that now I was like gay for a while. Now I identify as queer, because I'm like, somewhere on this spectrum.
I love the ability to discover parts of yourself along your journey.
Yeah.
Because that's what life is. Mm-hmm. There's no, you don't go, oh, I'm this forever. You go, oh, this is a new part of me. I'm figuring mm-hmm. this out. My journey when it comes to like bisexuality is dated girls all in high school, had a queer experience with a guy in college, and I was like, what's going on? Went back to girls, went to guys, had a boyfriend, didn't have a boyfriend. And so at that point I was like, oh, there's no confusion. This is just the thing.
Yeah.
This is what I'm enjoying.
Yeah.
And so many people are scared to say that for a number of reasons, but I'm lucky enough. And because, like, also, I'm still a queer comedian. Sometimes people think if you're bi, then you're going to be like, oh, do you anyone do straight shows? And I'm like, no. And like, do you want to do gay shows? I'm like, no, I'll do all everything. The shows. Right. I'll do, as long as the check clears, I'll do the show.
Right. I am every woman. but no, it's funny. Oh, no.
Go ahead.
No, yeah. I was just going to say, like, thinking about your work and things you talk about, like, I discovered you through the viral video where you were talking about your wedding.
Yes.
And for those who, for the, me and a million other people, I guess. But I got married in September, and it was a very similar getting married in New York. Or you're
introducing
what's everybody. Very funny about that. So that was my Tonight Show set, the Todd joke. And so I am always surprised. And shout out to NBC Universal Standards and Practices. I'll like submit my set and I'll be like, oh, y'all let me get away with this? Okay. Because my first Tonight Show set, I made a fantasy football joke and a group sex joke. And then that set, I also made like a fun little like kind of naughty wedding joke, the standing up punchline that I have in that. And I was like, they keep letting me get away with it. So that's always fun when people are like, oh, I love that.
But is it fun in your work, I guess, is like you're bringing your real life experiences to the stage and telling those stories. And that's part of what I think makes a great comedian is someone who can take their life experiences and actually then tell a story and a narrative. And it's funny because it's actually something that happened.
And I'm glad you said that, because this is actually a lesson to anyone who wants to do comedy. Live your life. Yeah. How the hell are you going to be interesting if you ain't done shit? Mm-hmm. How the hell are you going to have people empathize and connect with you if you ain't never been fired, if you've never been laid off, if you've never done anything fun? When I was an acting instructor, and I used to tell my students, I'd be like, listen, you got to live your life to be a good actor. No one wants to watch someone who the only thing they've ever done is want to be an actor. You want to watch someone who actually had their heart broken. You want to watch someone who has actually been worried about money. You don't want to watch someone who's like, I want to be the best. I just want to train. You're like, I don't care about that. There's nothing real, authentic, or interesting about that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's also why actors a lot of times get better with age, because you go, oh, you've been through some shit.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Oh, there's some seasoning on this cast iron pan.
Yes.
Speaking about craft and specifically comedy, so Wanda Sykes says that when it comes to comedy, we should never be punching down on marginalized groups of people. And there are several heterosexual comedians who've included polarizing jokes about queer folks.
Mm-hmm. I think we can't punch down if the kid is ugly. I think that's, if it's an ugly kid, punch down. Because they be biting. I was just in Times Square.
They be biting.
So
silver caps.
Is that the line? How do you decide if something's too edgy or crossing a line?
I like to make people laugh. That's my biggest goal. My biggest goal is to make a majority of the people, an overwhelming majority of the people in a crowd, laugh at the same time at the same thing for a reason that I deem acceptable. Now, I think when we get into like, oh, this is a rule no one can ever break, I think it's so hard to set those up.
Yeah.
What I would implore people to do is that maybe figure out why people are laughing at something. And if you're okay with having to stand, as Drewski says, on business about that joke. Mm-hmm. If you really love that joke that damn much. I have a wheelchair joke in my set, and it's not making fun of people in wheelchairs, but if there's someone in the crowd in a wheelchair, they're going to laugh at that joke. It just happened in Dallas. Someone said, oh, I love that wheelchair joke. I'm so glad you did it. And she messaged me. And I was like, I'm never going to write a joke and tell it and be scared to tell it in front of folks. I have a joke about lesbians. I do it in front of lesbians. There's no way I'm going to be too scared to tell that joke. Because then, what are you doing? You just want to talk about people behind their back? No. Say it right there.
Mm-hmm. You have to be sort of fearless in that. Because I'm just thinking about how, like, how one can get in their mind and go, you know, do the Olympics of it all, of just like, is this going to be offensive? Am I going to be canceled? And like, can I say this? What's the line I'm crossing here? And I'm just like, then you end up not doing anything.
Yeah, you end up not doing anything. And also, like, a perfect example for me is like, are you making fun of the way America treats trans women? Or are you making fun of trans women? Are you making fun of trans women as a whole? Or are you just making fun of one trans woman? Are you making fun of that woman for being dumb, Caitlyn Jenner, or are you making fun of that woman for being trans? That mm-hmm. these are the kind of situations mm-hmm. that comedians don't necessarily always want to talk about, because to some people it's boring. But I go, okay, what are we laughing at? Circle what you think the actual punchline for this is. Because I have a Caitlyn Jenner joke where I say, I think she's a groundbreaker. I think she's a trailblazer because she became America's first crazy conservative trans Fox News grandma. Mm-hmm. We don't have a lot of those. So shout outs to Caitlyn. She's on Fox News every other week being like, we got to get these girls out of sports. They're like, where you going, girl? She's like, to a golf tournament. Like, it's not... It's to me, at that point, I'm making fun of her hypocrisy. Mm-hmm. I can't make fun of that woman for being trans, but I can't make fun of her for killing that dude with a car. I can't, you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's what I want to make fun of. And so whenever we get into like punching down versus like punching up or like punching laterally, I think specificity and nuance are way more helpful than like hard and fast rules. Cause like, yeah. I'm never gonna say you can't make fun of somebody, but I'm saying it better be good. It better be good. They better laugh too. Cause like, what do you want? Do you want people to boo you so then you can talk about how mad you were that people booed you? Or do you mm-hmm. want people to go, God damn, that's good.
Yeah.
Damn, that's good. Do you want the group that you're making a joke about and or around to go, oh, God, that's good. You got me.
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds like you have a pretty good framework for how you think about these type of jokes. But do you ever have like a joke that's like, maybe a bit more edgy than you're used to? Do you do like a focus group? Do you test jokes out at brunch?
Yeah. This is what I like to test jokes out. Not the cellar, but there are other comedy opportunities I have throughout the city where I get to be like, oh, this is a new one. Like, I do my show at Union Hall every other Tuesday, pretty major. And like, we do like banter at the top, me and my co-host. And sometimes I'll be like, okay, let's see if there's anything here. As far as being edgy, like, I have a joke that is about breast cancer. And to me, cancer is one of those things that can make some people scared, make some people sad. And I'm not making fun of people who have lost their battle to breast cancer, but I was just making fun of one of the methods of discovery, just, you know, basically doing the action of like what they do with the mammogram. And the punchline is like, I'm talking about like a bad doctor, and he's like, put them in the machine, let's see if you get to keep them. And like, that's like a joke. But then it's also like, some people are like, oh, and so then the way you fix that is I have a tag where I go, and if that joke made you uncomfortable, go get checked. So that's like, to me, it's one of those things where like, you find what's the twist?
Yeah.
And like, some jokes are naughty, some jokes are like full on silly. So it's like a fun experiment every time.
Yeah. And I'm wondering if it depends on the crowd you're testing on whether they confiscate phones or make you put them in those bags that you can't like open. Like, if the crowd is able to like be like, you know, or if they're like, if they have their phone up and they're like, that's their viral moment because you said something, now it's catching, you know, legs or whatever. Or if it's like, okay, everyone's phone's away in here, so I'm gonna test some shit that might be unsavory.
I think that phones definitely can hurt someone trying to work on something, but I stand by everything I say on stage. There's like this weird, kind of thing that happens now is where sometimes people will film like a terrible interaction. So like, I think the most famous one is probably Michael Richards, like him going crazy and screaming the N-word that one time. But like, I think that when it comes to material, okay, like I stand on that. If someone like starts being crazy towards an audience member, at that point, that's like just a crazy interaction. You know what I'm saying? That's the difference between like having an actual fight with someone in the crowd and like someone like having unsavory or like unpolished material.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, that's true.
I watched The Closer finally in the Dave Chappelle special that everybody's up in arms about. I was like, I'm not interested in hearing him talk about this anymore. But I watched it for this. I was like, let me see how I feel about this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What I will say is that I think two things. I think he's a master of craft, and I think that is apparent. What I will also say is that if you're going to speak about experiences of communities that you are not a part of, that you should be very deft in your knowledge of it. And what was blatantly obvious to me was his lack of understanding of the concept of intersectionality. And like me as a Black queer person watching it, I was just like, none of this makes sense. It is very smartly worded and woven together, but for me, it didn't make sense.
There's a fun thing that happens whenever, and I'm so glad you brought up intersectionality. There's a fun thing that happens when people all of a sudden, and this is so fun to me, remember that Black queer people exist.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Because for so long, for so many people, and I don't know why this was, queerness, specifically male queerness, is just like shoved into this corner of whiteness.
Yeah.
So then you have a legacy and a history of Black male comedians kind of assuming that queerness is only for white people.
Yeah.
And then any aberration from that is so crazy. But then also somehow all of them also have a Black gay cousin. So it's like this weird like cognitive dissonance.
Yeah.
We're like, oh, Black people aren't queer, except for all these queer Black people. What are you talking about? To me, it's crazy.
Yeah.
To me, it's crazy that Boosie can't get it when he looks like a bunch of studs. It's wild. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. No, it was like, even when there's an exchange where he's talking about the white trans women, the two Black queer friends that she had with her. And she was talking about, my people have been down for decades. And he was like, I wanted to look at the Black people. I'm like, well, are y'all going to tell her? And I'm just like, actually, if you knew anything about intersectionality, the issue was with what she said, but then also the issue with you thinking that trans people, like, for all of y'all not thinking that trans people existed for centuries as well. Like, the oppression of both groups has happened for the same amount of time.
And arguably, like,
it's not different.
The most famous and impactful trans woman on the history of queer rights in this country is a Black trans woman.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the other crazy thing that people don't even talk about when it comes to comedy and history and legacy is that, you know who, now this is a little tea, do you know who the most famous Black queer comedian is?
Wanda Sykes?
Richard Pryor.
I was going to... that came up in my research. There was, he dibbled and dabbled.
Dibbled and dabbled.
Yeah.
Dibbled and dabbled. With who?
Marlon
Brando. And how do we know? Because Quincy Jones got drunk and felt like dinner.
No, everybody's tea.
Quincy Jones, shut up.
The daughter says, stop. Put your phone down.
Rashida definitely was like, dad, stop it.
Please delete the tweets.
And I think continuing with like talking about Black people, we're often finding humor in crazy situations, laughing is sometimes like a form of catharsis for us.
Yeah.
So growing up Black and queer, what painful moment in your life do you think would be a hilarious sketch comedy?
Ooh.
Ooh, well, let me pull out my pen.
Pain. Oh, I was always, okay, so I was a mama's boy. My mom worked at the school where I went to school. And one time I was so bad. One time, this other kid, he like laughed at me for doing something that just, I guess, wasn't manly enough. But also think about this. Like, it's so weird that little boys are like, that's not manly enough. I'm like, girl, we're all nine. None of us are manly. But like, someone laughed at me. And so then I got so mad. I was like, I don't know why you laughing. You can't read. Which in third grade, telling someone they can't read, that's the highest insult. you're going for the jugular. And then the teacher was like, Jay, you can't say that. Take that back. And I was like, Ms. Jenkins, he can't read. Make him read something right now. And my mom worked at the school, and Ms. Jenkins was friends with my mom. And my mom, she said, I'm having a sit down with your mom. And I was like, but he can't read. Mm. I was like very, very upset. And it was part of just like when you're young and you don't know why people are making fun of you and you just feel so overwhelmed by emotion.
Yeah.
And my mom definitely, I got in trouble. And that was one of those moments where I was like, I was made fun of and I don't know why it's fair for people to make fun of me and I can't make fun of them back. But looking back on it, it is hilarious that someone kind of like basically implied that I was a sissy and my response was, well, bitch, you can't read. Like, and it's like, because I mean, it's I just did the gayest thing ever. Mm-hmm. I was like, so? Like, yeah. You know? So to me, that's very funny.
I love that. For me, I think my sketch comedy bit would be around my dad's inconsistent presence in my life. So I felt like he was always either like in or out, or when he would pick me up, it would be like, I'm gonna pick you up. And then it would be like, I'll drop you off at your aunt and I'm with my aunt for the day. So it's like, you picked me up, but I'm not really spending time with you. So you're in and out. And I think it would be around, like everything would be more dramatized for the set. But I think it would be hilarious to see that happen. And also like, even when I'm thinking about when I was going into college, for instance, like in times when I needed him to be in my life, like he was going into rehab.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, this kind of would be hilarious to me to like, every time, you know, I'm thinking my dad's going to be around, he's inconsistent, you know, conveniently inconsistent, even if it's me going to college and then you going to rehab.
So. There's that one episode of Atlanta where Paperboy's trying to get his haircut, the Bibby episode. Like, that's, my dad was like that too. I'd be like, oh, he's going to pick me up. Oh, we got to go to these five places before we go back to my big mama's house. Your mama's house? You drop me off at big mama's house, baby. We just supposed to be hanging out. You pick me up from my mama's house to drop me off at your mama's house? Okay, Percy.
I would probably turn this one experience that my family won't let me forget because we bring it up every year. But when I was younger, around like 10 years old, I grew up in the same house as my grandmother, my mom, my aunt, and my cousin, who my cousin was 1 year older than me. And we played a game of hide and seek one day. And just for context, I had like a slightly larger head than normal when I was younger. So that'll come into play later. But I had the bright idea when we were doing hide and seek, it was my turn to hide. I was like, you know what? I'm going to hide on the top bunk of my bed. Me and my mom shared a room and I was on the top bunk. Uh-huh. And my strategy was that if my cousin came into the room and tried to find me, I would, if he was coming up the bed, which he did, I would slip through the crack between the bunk bed and the wall.
I see where this head is.
Like my body came through, ouch, clean as a whistle, and my head got stuck between the bunk bed and
you
the
like
wall.
Gina, take your head off.
I was like Gina.
You were like Gina.
Episode of Martin, but like,
what episode of Martin?
But like between the bunk bed frame and the wall, and my legs were like kicking. I was screaming. I was having like a full existential crisis. Yeah. And my cousin was just like laughing at me the entire time.
That's the funniest part of that. You tried to hate crime yourself? Yeah.
I thought that I was be able to just, you know, just slip right through and then I'll be on the bottom bunk and then I can roll out and move to a new hiding spot. I got stuck. And my cousin Jeff does not let me forget it. He brings it up like every Christmas. But I would like to turn that into a sketch comedy.
That's very funny.
That's I grew into my head.
You want to put a button on that one? I grew into my head.
Kids do take hide and seek so seriously to the point where, like, if you find them, they'll get mad. They'll be like, "No, it's not fair." So I understand. I understand like the level of like intensity required.
You're not, it was the strategy.
I think about the night that me and my ex-boyfriend broke up.
Ooh.
Oh, there may or may not have been psychedelics involved.
You broke up on mushrooms?
There may. And
you're like, I'm breaking up with all eight of y'all.
Exactly. And the relationship was volatile, I will say. And it did involve me like running out of the apartment, coming to Tony's house at 3 a.m, walking.
Okay.
He was also walking with me. He did not put shoes on.
Barefoot.
So when I think about this, I think about like it's Harlem. So you know niggas are like looking out the window.
Yeah.
Like I want to know what somebody's auntie was saying. Looking out the window, like, look at these sissies out here. I know it was funny. You know it was funny. Because we were screaming, carrying on. Like I think about this crazy period of my life through like this vacuum of just us, but I'm like, I know people heard it.
That
I
is
know
hilarious.
People saw it.
There definitely was somebody's TT that was like, he ain't worth it, girl.
Exactly.
Go
exactly.
home. Go
and
home.
I
put
like
some clothes on.
Bust into Tony's room at like 3 in the morning.
Mm-hmm. And I was laying in bed.
You were there.
Because I broke up with my boyfriend and I ran away from home.
Exactly.
No.
This was a night. And I had broke up with my boyfriend prior to Jordan breaking up with his boyfriend. So Jordan's staying on my bed.
And my boyfriend at the time in Tony's bedroom at 4 a.m. After having screamed our way through Harlem.
Oh, you opened up the door, I was like,
oh my God.
That would be a funny skit.
Wow. That
this is real life.
That is Well, this is why we need more black queer media, because that's a, that's an episode. That's a hilarious, that's a situational comedy, truly. That's a true kind of like to the art form, to the T, like old school situational comedy. Mm-hmm. A breakup, confined space. Y'all are breaking up. I just broke up. What are you doing here? What are you doing here? I'm high, but I'm still breaking up with you. Like, that is hilarious. I'm very sad. I'm sorry it happened, but it is very
funny. Oh, it's fine. We've moved on. I got married. It all worked out.
One time, I remember one time, it wasn't a breakup as much as, like, there was a guy who, like, wanted to hook up with me in college. And I was like, okay, but we can't. Okay, we can't, like, let anyone know. Like, so, like, this is what we're going to do. We're going to hook up, but then we got to leave the room at separate times. And I was like, okay. Perfect plan. And so, like, we hook up, and then, like, he's in the bathroom, and I'm like, okay, I'm gonna leave. And I, like, open the door, and it's, like, super quiet in this apartment where there was a party going on, and, like, everyone's just on the couch. And I was like, oh, so they heard everything. I was like, oh, we're stupid. They know. They know. No.
Absolutely. Oh my God. Well, this was fun.
Fantastic.
Jay, anything you wanted to tell our guests, like upcoming things you have going on, where they can find you?
Yes. I'm on tour. You can find tickets on all of my social media. If you just click the link tree, I'm going to be in Los Angeles, both like Los Angeles proper and Ontario and Irvine. I'm going to be in Philly. I'm going to be in Austin. Word. I'm going back to D.C. Let me tell the D.C. girl something. Y'all are mean. I love it. I love performing in DC. I truly do love it. It's so black and it's so queer, and I love every part of DC. But every time I post a video, the DC girls go, so you're not coming to DC? DC and Atlanta, those Instagram comments, they are the first ones to be like, oh, so you hate us. Oh, okay. What did we do to you, Jay? I'm coming back. I promise. So I'm on tour. I don't know. There's some fun stuff coming up. Maybe you'll see me on more things. The strike is over, so who knows if anyone wants to put me in stuff. I'm game. So yeah, just social media has been very helpful, especially for me. But I'm also lucky enough that, like, I'm good at comedy, because some people are good at social media and not stand up. You know, recent events. So I'm very happy to have the following and to have the amazing fans I do have. So just keep liking and sharing the clips and the reels, and buy tickets to a show, because it's good. I'm one of those people who, I'm good on the phone, but I'm good in real life too. Once again, some people ain't.
No, that's true. Okay. And we hate those people.
No,
We love everybody.
In my most Mississippi voice, bless their heart. I hope at one point they realize that this is still a live performance medium. So I'm going to need you to be good in person.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that is all the time we have this week. This season of Surface Level is presented by Mobi, Mobilizing Our Brothers Initiative. If you enjoyed this episode, let's keep the conversation going. Let us know your thoughts and questions at surfacelevelpodcast.com. And remember, stay curious.